Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor Stock Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We enjoy your company. We like hanging out with you, and we really, really appreciate all the wonderful things that you do for your community. And speaking of people doing wonderful things for their community, in studio today we've got Rosemary Chump, former International Vice President for SEIU.
Well, it's always wonderful to be here. Thank you, Charles.
Rosemary, happy birthday.
Oh, well, thank you. Only 39.
There you go. And she doesn't look 39. I mean, I was like 28, something like, you know, I don't know. My wife was jealous, you know. Also in studio today, what's his name that hangs up? No, Charlie McAllister, doctor, professor, and machinist, and guy used to work with Unite here, too.
That too.
Charlie, it's always a pleasure.
Great
we appreciate
to be here.
It. Guys, wow.
Yeah.
It's always fun to have you here. I'm still trying to get over the Rosemary's birthday card. We're not going to talk about that. But,
but have to have a little humor in life, too.
A lot of humor in life,
exactly.
Thank God.
Exactly.
Rosemary, what's going on?
Well, we're about to, on September 24, and not only are we going to be, all this year celebrating the 100th anniversary year of the national parks, but we'll be opening up a new National Museum on the Mall in Washington, D.C., dedicated to African Americans, which tells the story of, slavery, 400 years of slavery in our country. And I will say that, I think that in recognition of that, there are two recent stories that create some degree of positive motion on behalf of African Americans, one in Virginia and the other in terms of the U.S. government being in the business of running private prisons to incarcerate federal prisoners. The fact that it's now going to go away, which is a very good thing, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But with respect to Virginia, I really, current governor Terry McAuliffe, really deserves a shout out for trying to, rectify an injustice that has gone on in Virginia for so many years of basically incarcerating African-Americans at, a high rate, particularly for low-level crimes. And then, of course, because of that incarceration, taking away their voting rights. And Governor McAuliffe tried to restore the voting rights to over 200,000 African-Americans who served their time, paid their debt to society, gone back into the regular everyday part of living, but being disenfranchised of their right to vote. And he tried to do something about this, and the state legislature and the courts of Virginia rose up and said, "Oh, well, you can't do that in just with one fell swoop of a pen. You have to do it on a case-by-case basis." So to the credit of the governor and his staff, they reviewed 13,000 applications of African American who, in fact, exercised their registration right to vote. And he individually permitted each one of them to say, "You've met all the requirements of being a citizen of the United States, and therefore I'm re-enfranchising you." So,
one of the things that to put this in perspective, there some of the organizations that are out there have been pushing very hard for convicted felons to be able to buy a gun again.
There you go.
There you go. So
let's get our priorities right.
Yeah. So
guns or votes. Oh.
So if our friends that are out there are pushing to make sure that people can buy a gun after being convicted of a felon and having served their time, perhaps they forgot about voting, and we should remind them and get them on board with that. I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, I think that's an excellent point, Charles. I did not know that. And now that's a shocking statement. That's a real shocker. But we do have a situation in this country, and I'm so glad that the government has finally recognized that the story of African Americans need to be told, and a museum to help tell that story is going to be dedicated, and it will be free to all who want to go and visit. And I hope all of us as a nation make our pilgrimage to D.C. and make that a priority museum in order to see, because really, you know, we're still living with the vestiges of slavery. I mean, essentially, you know, when there are not enough life-sustaining jobs out there where people have to work for slave wages, that's a problem in our country, when they don't have enough money in order to live on and to pay housing and food and clothing and all the necessities of life. And then when they, you know, when they pass laws that say, oh, by the way, you don't have the freedom of assembly or speech because we're passing a right to work for less law that says you can't really have a union represent you, that's a problem, because then they don't have a voice at the workplace to improve those slave wages or to improve those slave-like conditions of the work. And then when they deny their right to vote, and then they create, you know, automatic laws that if you do X, Y, Z, you must go to jail. Do not pass go. You know, really? So those are all issues, and we need to, you know, I applaud the governor's efforts in Virginia, and I applaud President Obama for starting a program to phase out private prisons for federal inmates.
Really? You know, I got to tell you that I have friends that work for the Bureau of Prisons. They're corrections officers, corrections supervisors. They do anybody inside working within federal corrections. Number one, they categorically do great work. They house the worst, the nastiest of terrorists and the rest that are out there. And they do it in an appropriate way, day in, day out. These private prisons create so many problems. And the long and short of it is imagine somebody that stands to make a profit on where you're at inside the prison. And they are your judge, your jury, your executioner, your sentencer, and the person that will be there for your entire sentence. There is all too often no reprieve outside to come help. Family can't help. I mean, $6 a minute telephone calls. You know, these kinds of things. The abuses have piled on high.
Absolutely.
We need to stop the privatized prisons here in the United States. We need to put it back into the hands of the professionals, back into the hands of the people that do it appropriately, that don't stand to gain a profit, that don't stand to make money, that are not writing campaign contributions, so on and so forth.
And whose emphasis is rehabilitation.
Right.
I mean, we desperately need to help. I mean, there was a great book, a very famous book, and had a huge impact, I'm sure, on this whole issue of phasing out privatized prisons, called The New Jim Crow, which really shows how the extension of slavery and discrimination and the voting laws in the South that block people from having any access to the ballot have been extended through three strikes, you're out, through all kinds of punitive sentences on the poorest and on the minorities in this country. And then the people are locked in places where people are making a profit on them, where there's no incentive to rehabilitate them, where, in fact, every incentive is to not rehabilitate and to keep them as long as they can in order to generate the money.
Right.
And so this is a terrible system where you're condemning huge numbers of people.
Even minors.
Really?
We had a judge here in Pennsylvania that was convicted and sent to jail properly.
Right.
For sending minors to prison
for almost, I mean, tiny offenses. I mean, kid acting up in school, I mean, and stuff, and gets called a truant officer or whatever, and then they just keep piling on the sentences.
Right.
And once they get them in, you got a 14, 15-year-old kid who's rebellious. You're going to find plenty more reasons to extend that kid's imprisonment. It is a terrible system which really needs to be rethought completely and based on rehabilitation, on reentry, and on productive
right.
jobs when people get out.
Right. And it is rehabilitation is very effective when it is done properly.
Right.
It is very effective.
But you got to have things on the outside that help people find a place to live,
right?
Where jobs are made available and people are helped to make the transition.
Right. And you know, we need to continue working towards it. Listen, guys, we're going to take a short break. We'll come back. We'll talk some more. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborist Talk Radio.
Do your homework before the election, or pay the price potentially with your job. That's the message one of the key figures in the fight for workplace equality has for Florida women. After discovering she earned less than her male colleagues at the Goodyear tire plant, Lily Ledbetter took her fight for equal pay all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, with the election looming and an open seat on the high court, she's urging Florida women to think long and hard about which presidential candidate is most likely to advance the cause.
We are still so far, far behind. Women still do not get the benefits and the rights that they are entitled to. It is one of the most unbelievable situations in this country.
While Ledbetter lost her case in a 2007 split decision, Congress eventually did pass the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which was the first act signed into law by President Obama in 2009. Hillary Clinton was a sponsor of that legislation, while Republican vice presidential nominee Mike Pence voted against it. Ivanka Trump said during the Republican convention that her father would likely look at the pay bias issue. Donald Trump, however, has said he'd expect his daughter to leave her job if she were being discriminated against. Teresa King is the president of the Florida Building Trades and says that simply isn't an option for most working women.
To suggest that if I was sexually harassed on a job site, that I am the one who should change careers is an absolute insult to not only me, but to every woman that works daily to have their own American dream.
King says she and other members of the Florida AFL-CIO will spend the next few months going door to door, trying to educate Florida voters about the importance of women's issues in this election. Ledbetter says her landmark case may have turned out very differently if a different set of judges sat on the bench. Two of the Supreme Court justices that sided with Ledbetter have since retired, and one who voted against her has died. With one high court vacancy in play, she says it's a reminder that the decisions the next president make will outlive him or her.
It could determine our lives for generations to come, and this year is no less. It is the most critical year of my life.
President Obama and congressional Democrats have tried to pass separate legislation to make it easier for workers to sue for wage discrimination, but that has been blocked by Republicans, who argue it would be a boon for trial lawyers that won't help close the pay gap. For Florida News Connection, I'm Mona Shand.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We enjoy your company. We like hanging out with you, and we really, really appreciate all the wonderful things that you do for your community. In studio today, Rosemary Trump.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Also, Charlie McCullister. Charlie.
Great to be here.
Guys, we appreciate it. Before we get into it, for all of our friends, the Westmoreland County Democrats kick off the 2016 fall campaign picnic August 28th, 2016, at the Mammoth Park Pavilion number 2. For more information, get a hold of them, 724-289-7000. 724-289-7000. Westmoreland County Dems. Rosemary.
Okay, yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's always a fun picnic. They have freshly shucked corn on the cob and
if it's
all sorts of desserts.
If it's Mammoth Park, do you get like Brontosaurus burgers too?
Right, sure.
Sorry.
Ah, there you go.
How did you come up with that name?
We'll and it's a beautiful park, so come on out, everyone.
We appreciate
it'll
it.
Have a great
no
time.
No fishing with dynamite this year. Charlie. So, you know, we're talking about the privatized prisons.
Yes.
And, you know, Rosemary, you brought up, you know, how can anybody be an investor in this?
Exactly. There are two companies that actually are on stock markets, so they have replaced the public marketplace for African Americans that existed for years and years and at town squares, now with a marketplace on Wall Street where you can make money on imprisoning people. And we know that, you know, there's
or the immigration the detention. Or immigration detention.
Exactly. People of color. And, you know, are for sale on Wall Street. So that, just imagine how the stock would go up if you passed a law that, hey, every person of color born is going to go to jail for their lifetime. That would drive up the price of the stock, so you could make a lot of money, you know. So in any event, people should be aware that by having these private prisons, really, there is no incentive not to have people in those prisons. Because first of all, you know, they make money on the stock market. Number two, they're able to have influence on laws because now they're in play and they can buy, legislators so that they will vote for more laws to imprison more people, which, by the way, could be me and or you, the listening member of our audience, because that will help keep the prisons full so that they make more money. And, number three, they're able to have no incentive to train people, but they could employ those prisoners, and they do for cents on the hour, pay them, 30 cents, 50 cents, a dollar an hour,
right.
Whatever.
Don't need slave labor. You get prison labor.
Exactly.
And one of the
things... Which, by the way, we're competing against. You and I, listen to me, blue-collar America, we're competing against that prison labor. Just
right.
like blue-collar workers of yesteryear competed against slave labor.
Right. We're not talking about they're making license plates and that kind of stuff for the state or for the federal government. No, these guys oftentimes are engaged in commercial work.
Yep.
And if you own a business and you're trying to compete against these guys, you tell me how you compete against them.
30 cents an hour wage. Yeah.
Chinese can't compete against that.
It's slave labor.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And of course, let's not worry about, the cost of food, feed them. I mean, we're going back to the Middle Ages, where you feed them any old thing just to keep them alive so that they can show up at work to make 30 cents an hour so that you can make, $300 an hour. It's just an outrage, and frankly, there needs to be a law. We talk about there ought to be a law. There ought to be a law where private corporations cannot be in the market of selling stocks on people's misfortune and misery.
Absolutely. Charlie.
Well, it brings up this central idea, I think, that we've been talking a lot about, is appropriate federal role in things. You need federal regulations. When you have a disaster in Louisiana, suddenly people who are against governmental action are crying for governmental help. And we have a situation right now, we're celebrating the 100th anniversary of the National Park System, one of the greatest roles of the federal government that has protected enormous amount of very beautiful places so that to not be destroyed, to not be commercially developed, but to be kept in trust for the American people. And the very people who have privatized prisons are calling for a devolution of federal lands to state control, which
right.
is one step toward privatization. Once they get state control in the hands of right-wing legislators like Pennsylvania, then you're
saying...
Yeah,
quite honestly, Charlie, it's more than fracking on the land. It's more than running your cattle across the land. It's, oh my God, we found a seam of coal underneath this. We're going to, we're going to, mountaintop
removal.
Right. Strip mine
right.
this whole area. Be careful what you wish for.
Right. I think what the bottom line here is there's a very appropriate role for for government, for the federal government. Right. It doesn't mean there isn't corruption, and we all know it. And we know, and what, but what I think we share is that most of the corruption is at the top, because that's where the money flows, so the lobbyists and the corporate interests. But what we are interested in is the workers, those federal, state, national parks people, those people who work in the correction institutions, those workers who at every level, whether at FEMA, are professionals who come on the scene when there is a disaster, who know what to do, know what they can do, but also are restricted constantly by the lack of funding from above. So that's the struggle, how to make government, how to reward the people actually doing the work, paying them a decent salary, giving them, letting them have their rights as union workers, but also keeping a good eye on the people running the show, because that's where the corruption usually is. And the people who want to cut the bottom but leave the top intact, they're the problem.
Again, I know people that work in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, they're prison officers, corrections officers, and others in there. There is a world of difference between the level of professionalism and the way they're treated and the non-union hire anybody at the lowest rate of pay we can find, and make sure that they're working towards the end of the quarter profits as opposed to what's in the best interest of the community. And it's wrong. Our brothers and sisters within the BOP at the federal level and some of the other unions at the state level have brought this up time and time again. And quite frankly, if we continue to allow this, we just continue to do a major, major harmful disservice to our communities.
Well, and now that we've got the ball rolling where the federal government is getting out of the business of private prisons, we really do need to begin a campaign to get them out of the state business. And frankly, we need to pass a law that says you can't make money off of people right. while being incarcerated.
Right. You know, and I got to say this. When I was with immigration, there are times when somebody is put on a detainer and held by an immigration judge or waiting to see an immigration judge. And all too often, these people that are being held for trial end up in a county lockup, or even worse, a state lockup or a privatized lockup. And they're treated like any other, they're treated like criminals in there. Mm-hmm. When immigration, the vast majority of immigration, despite what the opposition wants to say, is administrative. Okay? This is like, oh my goodness, you didn't get the right color of your eyes on your driver's license. That's what we're talking about. You know? That's the kind of thing we're talking about. And you lock some mother up without her kids. There's a better way of doing things. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor's Talk Radio.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises.
For WIN, I'm Joanne Powers. While the city of San Diego raised its minimum wage to $10.50 an hour in July, over 10,000 home care providers in the state's in-home supportive services program are being denied this increase, being paid only the state minimum wage of $10 an hour. United Domestic Workers filed a complaint with the city treasurer at the end of last week. Darlene Johnson is a home care provider with the UDW.
We live in one of the most expensive cities. There's a lot of us that barely keep our heads above water. We take care of the most vulnerable people in the country. We take care of people with disabilities and seniors. And to be denied the wage increase is telling us that what we do is invaluable as home caregivers.
On June 30th, the Mayo Clinic announced plans to outsource all food service work at their 20 locations nationwide. The change will affect over 700 workers in Minnesota and hundreds more across the country. Members of the Service Employees International Union have delivered a petition to get Mayo to revisit their decision. After helping finance the company's new medical center in Rochester, Minnesota, to the tune of $500 million in taxpayer money, 30 state lawmakers also delivered a petition to the company last week. Jamie Gulley is president of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota.
The decision by the state legislature and the governor was made on the understanding that Mayo was intending to create good jobs in the community. And here they are subcontracting out 700 really good family-supporting jobs. They're doing this to increase their profits and at the expense of the community.
Average pay for food service workers in Rochester is $7 more than that of typical employees at the subcontractor. And the union calculates that it will cost workers $4 million in lost wages and benefits.
Most workers would see a $4,200 a year pay cut just from the insurance changes. And the difference in retirement programs for a 30 to 40 year employee, you're looking at a difference of about $100,000 over their retirement. So these are changes that will dramatically impact the lives of a lot of workers and the economy in our community.
Unions in Oregon are campaigning for a ballot measure that will require corporations with over $25 million in sales in the state to pay their fair share and help fund public education, health care, and senior services. With the lowest corporate taxes in the nation, Oregon has seen significant divestments in those services. Measure 97 would affect about 1,000 mostly large and out-of-state corporations. Hannah Vandering is president of the Oregon Education Association.
Everyday Oregonians have reached into their pockets and said, we want our students to have a quality education, while corporations have stood by and just asked for more tax breaks. And that's not right. Everyone has to step up and pay their fair share.
Brought to you by the Alliance for American Manufacturing, working to prevent the loss of American jobs caused by unfair foreign competition, and working to promote fair trade laws to level the playing field for American workers. Information on how you can help create smart, worker-focused public policy is online at AmericanManufacturing.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit LaborRadio.org.
If you own a gun, you have a full time.
Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Labor Stock Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We appreciate you hanging out with us for the afternoon. In studio today, Rosemary Trump.
Hey, it's wonderful to be here today.
Always a pleasure. Happy birthday, Rosemary.
Thank you.
Not a day over 39. And Charlie McAllister.
Hey, great to be here.
Not a day over 41.
Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. So, you know, we've been talking a lot about corrections and, you know, that whole industry needs to be revamped and done away with, quite honestly. Environmentally, what are we going to be doing?
Well,
go ahead.
All right. Well, here is poor Louisiana. 11 years ago at this time, at this very time, 11 years ago, August of 2005, a major hurricane hit Louisiana, and particularly New Orleans. And the aftermath of that situation. And now, you know, there's been major rainfall in
this wasn't near even a storm.
Baton Rouge.
This wasn't even a storm. This was a thunderstorm that came through that dropped a lot of rain and clocked southern Louisiana.
Exactly.
This was not a hurricane coming in off the Gulf.
Yeah. Exactly. So once again, here are, you know, over 40,000 homes underwater and hundreds of thousands of workers and businesses interrupted and needful of subsidy. And yet we still have our so-called fiscally conservative Republicans saying, you know, those Democrats, all they are is tax and spend, tax and spend. While those fiscal conservatives are no taxes and no spending, and only 12% of those homes had any kind of insurance to help them with rebuilding. And now, all of a sudden, there's one or two of the individual so-called fiscally responsible and conservative congressmen saying, what do you mean that we're only going to be able to give $33,000 per family assistance? $33,000, they lost a home that's worth a lot more than that. Plus, they lost their furniture, and they lost their clothing, and they lost, you know, all of their goods.
And on top of that, Tony Perkins, the guy from the Family Foundation,
that
says, you know, all these storms here in the United States are because God's telling America to stop
you know, being kind to gays. Well, his house was destroyed.
Oh,
so what's God telling him?
Yes, exactly.
You know, I mean,
that's a problem when you start knowing God's mind. It gets difficult.
Can you translate that one for me, please? Yeah. He whacked your home, you know, and you know you're living in a trailer, dude. But you know, and my gut, you know, in addition to that, you know, those people who weren't really concerned about Katrina. And weren't really concerned about the loss of life and the suffering that people went through because they didn't go through it. It wasn't people that looked like them that went through it. Right. Are now saying, well, you know what? That big project that the government had for putting in locks and expanding out the whole ecosystem to absorb more and more of these kinds of storms that are coming up. We don't want to spend the money on that. You know, those people that don't look like them kind of, well, you know, that was their problem. My house was okay. I bet you that's what Tony Perkins was saying.
Well, and then you have incredible, I mean, at the same time you have massive floods in Louisiana, you have some of the worst forest fires. Well, I think it is the worst forest fire in terms of the rapidity with which it has moved through California. You have just this incredible dichotomy. I mean, we're seeing this all the time. Huge floods, high temperatures, forest fires, the aquifers going down all around the West and in the Midwest.
Right.
We have
the Colorado River doesn't make it to the ocean anymore.
We have an ecological crisis here, folks, and we really need to respond to it. But the only way some people want to respond to it is by denouncing anybody who raises it and to call them unscientific or liars or whatever. And we really need to.
Who was that company representing the tobacco industry?
Yeah, it sort of sounds like that, doesn't it? Yeah.
So there is a climate change issue, and we have to deal with it. And in order to deal with it, we have to deal with fossil fuels. Plain and simple.
Didn't we just have somebody in here talking about electric cars and solar cells and
yes,
that kind
we
of
did.
Stuff?
Yes, we did. Thank you.
That is why I say that, you know, that oil and that natural gas and all the rest of it is so valuable. We need to keep it in the ground to keep it safe.
Exactly. And what we also need to be talking about is the expansion of solar and wind. There are those who are saying, oh, no, we've got to, you know, the clean energy future of tomorrow is nuclear energy, that we got to invest in lots
Fukushima.
Of nuclear energy.
Yeah, right. How do you say Fukushima?
Fukushima. How do you say Chernobyl?
Yeah, really.
Yeah, well, and how do you say New Mexico and South Carolina recently?
Right.
I mean, basically what happened in New Mexico was another big cover-up, you know, where essentially they had a nuclear waste bomb go off, and it's taking $2 billion to clean that up. And at the same time, in South Carolina, you know, the federal regulators are having to review what's going down there because essentially their scrubber, you know, when they went to scrub it, they found out that there was three times more nuclear waste on that filter or whatever system they have, which exposed 178 workers to an excessive amount of radiation. And so now that part of the plant is closed down so that it can be reevaluated. And so, you know, the other problem is that they were required under the law to give 24 hours notice to the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. They didn't do that for over a month until they sort of wiped up some of the mess. And so how can we trust that industry? And why would we want to invest in it where we have no place to put the nuclear waste and to keep it safe? And that's what happened in New Mexico. They could not keep the waste product from the energy being produced safe, and that has created a big damage problem. So the bottom line is nobody wants to really talk about wind and solar because they say, oh, you know, the wind doesn't always blow or the sun doesn't always shine.
All we have to do is...
As you often say, we need a smart grid, and I think we should talk about how important that is.
We should. But I tell you what, all we need is one wind turbine over top of Congress with all that hot air. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Hello, welcome back. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to the Union Edge Laborers Talk Radio. Thank you very much for tuning in. We enjoy your company. We like hanging out with you. And we really, really appreciate all the wonderful things that you're doing for your community. We appreciate that very much. And so today, Rosemary and Charlie.
Good to be here.
Guys, always a pleasure. We appreciate it. Happy birthday, Rosemary.
Thank you.
And my goodness, 39 again.
That's a good number. Me and Jack Benny, we agree on all things.
Is that like your money or your wife? I'm thinking. Yeah. So smart grid. You know, the smart grid, basically what it is it takes, it shifts the energy back and forth. It reduces a lot of the line loss because it's newer technology, it's newer wires. We lose about anywhere from 10 to 30% of the electricity that we make here in the United States. No matter how we make it, we lose it just in the transmission itself. That's how old and bad the lines are. And they overheat and they start losing more. With the smart grid, it kind of regionalizes it, but we can share back and forth between regions to help each other out. And then there are special meters on everybody's house that if your house has solar panels or your house has a wind turbine or a bicycle with a generator on it, and you're making more electricity than you're using, your house meter goes backwards. You're putting more into the grid than you're taking out of it. You're ideally make it a couple off of there. I'd love to see it so the electric companies have to pay you wholesale rates, not this double extra cheap that we make right. A lot of money off of rates. Make it more fair. Right. But the smart grid, I mean, Charlie, if we started building the smart grid today in New York City, by the time we got to California, our great-great-grandchildren would still be working on this project until their retirement.
Well, I mean, we really have to look at a national plan. We have to look at a national training system to develop the workforce, which the unions well positioned to pick up and run with and provide competent, well-trained people. And we need to look at this as a total entity. There was a program yesterday on National Public Radio on how much on the edge and how many blackouts we have had. It's been upping every year. I mean, now we're a few, I'm not sure what the like 10 years ago there were 3 or 4 major ones. Now then it went up to 30, and now we're up over 100 major blackouts a year, and it's going to do nothing but increase because we're not putting the investment into our national and international system. So this really has, and we could be a model, once again, if we get ahead of the curve and develop these things, because there has to be a way of integrating solar, which obviously only works in the day, wind, which works when the wind is blowing, with other forms of energy, hydro and geothermal, and to some degree some fossil fuel as a buffer. These have to be integrated into a rational system that's able to provide electricity, and we need to develop storage capacity, which is what we see happening with Tesla and others really looking at this issue, because this is the issue of the future. So how do we put all that together? We really need massive amounts of scientific and technical discussion, and we need a public policy. That's the part that's going to be the hardest.
But you know, but here's the thing. I mean, the technology between a really, really good, well-built wind turbine and a really crappy wind turbine made in China, the technology is practically nothing. It's the skill of the machinists
right.
making the gearboxes. It's the skill of the metal workers forming the barrel of the tower, the housing compartment, in the turbines, the wind, the propellers themselves. But this is not rocket science. I mean, right. we've been perfecting and we've been doing a better and better job, but the breakthrough happened the epiphany happened in the 1950s.
Right.
Okay. You know, the difference between a 1950s solar cell and a solar cell today, the guys in the 50s would recognize today's and they'd say, oh, that's how they solved that problem. But it's still a solar cell. It's not rocket science. And, right. you know, that new plant up in Buffalo.
That's so encouraging. That is the great hope. I mean, here we have a major American plant that's going to turn it out on a high industrial scale. This is really mm-hmm. what we need all over the country.
Right. You know, and, you know, if we get Buffalo running and humming and, you know, and we get solar cells down to the price of like 10 cents a watt. Holy gee, Hasserfats, man. Yep. I mean, that's a game changer. That's a huge game changer. I mean, you know, on a 2,000 square foot house that you've got, you know, the one roof slanted towards the south, you got 1,000 square feet of solar cells. Oh my God! You know, you're running you're more than doing 5,000-6,000 watts in a day.
And we really have to think about a decentralized system that is less vulnerable to huge weather storms that could be catastrophic, to floods, and to terrorism. If you have a decentralized system, which millions of houses are contributing to both using and putting into the grid on a decentralized way, instead of being dependent on a handful of relatively huge power plants, it's going to change the entire system.
Right. And in addition to that, if we go about rebuilding the grid here in the United States and we put it below ground, okay, in a 4x4 or a 6x6 concrete structure underground, okay, and protect those wires, next time a hurricane comes through, when the hurricane leaves, people turn on their lights and the electric's there.
And the other important thing is the technical side of it, but it's also the human side of it. Because to be able to move toward this, we need a public policy that deals with those workers who are going to easily find more jobs, like electrical workers, and those who are going to have to make transitions. And we need a way to make sure that these people are able to maintain a living union wage and get retrained for a different type of work. So those two things have to come together, the technical side of it, the training, and then the workforce itself. How are we going to adapt this workforce to the new reality?
We're going to still have people saying, no, I don't want people paying taxes on making $30 an hour. I want them paying taxes on wage taxes on making $8 an hour. You know, it's incredible. And those people that are saying, oh, well, you know, we can't afford to repair our roads, and we can't afford to repair our bridges, and we can't afford to repair our locks and our dams and our electrical systems. They are just being greedy, okay? And I really wish that they would stay off my roads and bridges and off of my rivers and not use the electricity that we as taxpayers have put together to send it to their house. As a matter of fact, just start generating your own electricity. And oh, by the way, don't be sending your diesel fumes over towards my house because that's your garbage. I'm just saying, you know, so I'm getting.
Well, it does come down to that. It's, you know, what is the responsibility of society? We have been basically living off the investment of our mothers and fathers and our grandfathers and grandmothers. They're the ones that put up the money, the tax dollars, to make this initial infrastructure investment. Now it's our turn, you know, to put up the
right.
money and to have sensible policies of putting up the money. And we need to look at what our grandmothers and grandfathers did, which was go to the bank that has the money in it, which is the wealthy and corporations who are not paying their fair share because they've been able to lobby their way and buy enough representatives to make sure that they don't pay their fair share.
And by the way, this whole thing is a public-private joint effort.
Right.
The government lends the money to the private sector to do the job, to hire people, and to get paid a profit and repay the government. Let's remember that. The government gets repaid. You know, so this is the kind of thing that that needs to be done, and it's a joint effort.
And it's a win-win situation.
Right.
Just like the government lent General Motors and other auto manufacturers money when They were in trouble. The government got repaid. And guess what? There are living wage jobs. There are family-sustaining jobs being paid in Michigan as a result of that. When the Republicans were, oh, boo-hooing, you know, we're going to lose all this money and it's never going to be repaid and it's going to cost unemployment to skyrocket and, you know, all you people are a bunch of socialists. You know, the fact is it worked out. America won, families won, cities won, the state of Michigan won, and yet, you know, we still have those naysayers that government is bad, taxes are bad, investment by government is bad. Meantime, they're robbing the bank.
Right, and they want everybody else to pay for their roads and bridges and so on and so forth.
Well, and the key thing, too, one of the things that has been starting to happen in different states, I think California and Washington State or Oregon are leading it, is to overthrow Citizens United, to begin state movements to challenge in a very serious way, because we have got to restrict the money that is corrupting the highest levels of all levels of our government, but particularly the national and the state level, where this incredible money machines that are out there that are twisting everything and putting it in their favor, these have to be restricted. We have to get, and we have to know where the money's coming from. The fact that a presidential candidate cannot tell you, show his tax forms and show where investment in his real estate has come from, from Russia or wherever.
We have a presidential candidate that is harming us, harming our allies, and supporting our enemies. Very seriously, folks. Harming our friends, harming our allies, harming us, and supporting our enemies. God forbid that ever turns into war. God forbid. Guys, it's always a pleasure. We appreciate it, and we will talk to you soon. Rosemary Trump, Charlie McAllister. I'm Charles Showalter. You're listening to The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio.